everyone, to a very special minute of the Great Escape Minute by Minute podcast, where we dig into the Great Escape 1 minute at a time. Today, we are joined by David McCallum, one of the original members of the cast of the film. Welcome, David.
Thank you, yes. I believe the only American or living in America member of the cast is still alive.
And we hope that that'll remain that way for many, many more years.
Oh. We'll do what we can.
You should have good health. That's the important thing here.
Thank you.
Okay, so every day we're talking about the movie The Great Escape. We're going very in-depth into the movie, discussing very small tidbits on everything. But in this episode, we're going to get a general overview of what it was like to be a part of the cast and what it was like to make the film itself. So we probably should start from the beginning. How did you get the part? You played Eric Ashley Pitt, Dispersal. And so how did you get the part?
Well, there's a political start to this whole thing, because Britain after the war kicked Churchill out, and Clement Attlee came in, and Britain sort of went socialist. And I was brought up to be very conservative. My mother and father did it by example. They didn't lecture me or anything about politics, but I always felt that the individual is more important than anything, and the harder you work, the better you were rewarded. And I didn't really demand anything of anybody. And so when Britain went socialist, I decided that I looked around and saw the United States of America. And, I'd seen it on the films, as they say. And so I thought, I'm going to try and go there. So I had an agent by the name of Derek Marr, a wonderful man who was very instrumental in making my career move along quite rapidly. And I can't remember the sequences of everything. I know I worked with John Huston in Freud, but the opportunity to be one of the escapees from the Great Escape, from the camp, came along, and I jumped at it. I mean, I was just cast as one of the members of the cast. I mean, you didn't really do anything. Your agent called you up and said they'd like you to play, and I said, fine, wonderful, when do we start? And myself, my wife then, Jill, and our son, Peter, I can't remember if he came the first time, but we got in the car, and I drove to Munich. And we moved into a hotel, and it was tremendously welcoming. Bob Relier and John Sturges, and I forget the name of the first assistant, but, they gave you letters and said, do you need babysitters, and do you need this? Whatever you need, they'd get for you. It was a wonderful production to be on. And that's how it all came about.
Okay, great. Great to hear that story. Did you at all identify with the character that they gave you to play Eric Ashley Pitt?
I didn't know anything about him at that point. I knew he was a flyer. And, the first thing you do is go into wardrobe, and they put, the uniform of a flyer with the insignias on it, so you know what rank you are and everything. And once I had the clothes and I had the name, I knew who he was. Subsequently, towards the end of the movie, I learned a few things about his wife and family, but I don't remember at this point exactly if that led to anything. How long ago is it?
The movie came out in 1963, so it's been 58 years.
63, so that we've been doing it around 1962.
Right.
Yeah. Plus the 21 of this year.
Yes.
So that's, it's quite a while ago.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Okay, but whatever you can remember is great for us to hear about. That's the important thing for us. Because as you mentioned before, there aren't many people we can still ask to tell us about the experience itself.
Well, there's so many things that you remember. You remember that everybody competed to fly the airplane into the tree. They were all, you know, amateur pilots, American pilots. They wanted to fly the thing into the tree. And some of the actors wanted to do it, too. And Donald Pleasant, who was a good friend of mine, what I remember is there is a thing called Galbus Haxa, which is basically, what do you call it? It's a knuckle of veal, and they cook it very slowly with lots of onions, and it's delicious. Veal shanks, yes, veal shanks. And the best veal shanks I've ever had in my whole life was the restaurant by the lake, Starnberg Lake, which was close to the camp and close to the hotels. And we spent a lot of time there eating, overlooking the lake. And on weekend trips, they had a map in the production office of the world, and principally Europe. But each week, when various members of the cast and their wives decided to go off and check out Paris and check out London, they put pins with their names on this map. So they knew where all the cast was with a push pin. But everybody was traveling around, moving about. And Jill, my wife, became very friendly with Steve McQueen's wife, Neely. And they went off to London and they went here together. They did lots of things together. And out of that, of course, they made an arrangement in Beverly Hills for her son, Jason. We adopted a boy in California, Jason, who sadly died subsequently of an overdose of drugs because he got involved in 70s culture. But back then, it was a very happy time. We had all had a wonderful time together.
Yeah, it definitely sounds that way. How long were you on the set? The entire, like, how long was the whole production?
I think back then, I used to think of a movie as 12 weeks. I know when I did the Freud, Montgomery Clift, I was only supposed to be there for a couple of days. And that worked itself into a week. And the week worked itself into 6 weeks or many weeks. Because we never got the thing finished. And Montgomery Clift became a very close friend. And it's funny with Monty, I remember the moment when I heard that he died. I was on Santa Monica Boulevard going past the car wash. And I pulled over and I remember I'm weeping. And Monty had died. What a wonderful man.
Wow. Wow.
There's so many memories, you know.
Yeah,
they tumble out. And I get a bit like Ducky. I get garrulous.
Right. It's completely understandable. Because as you said, you spend a lot of intense time with people. You become friendly with them. You become friendly with their spouses, their kids, you know, whoever's there on the set with you. So it makes sense that afterwards, you know, you can have a stronger bond with those other actors who you're working with. It makes sense.
And you rarely see them. You know, Monty came over to London to visit myself and Jill at one point. But that's the wrong film. Let's get back to The Great Escape.
Well, again, we want to hear about your experiences. So it's connected.
Well,
you're right.
I did a series called Cold It, which had the similar thing in that you had your own bunk bed. And so in the camp on the set, we all had bunk beds. We knew where we were assigned and which hut, which was great because any time you had an hour off, you could just climb in your bunk and go to sleep. Very effective. It would be useless now because they'd never be able to wake me.
were there long days of filming, or because it was such an ensemble cast,
there were a lot of creative juices flowing. And Steve McQueen and John Sturgis, the essence of that movie, which is, it's a guy's movie, that grew out of conversations between Steve McQueen and John Sturgis in John's office. They disappeared sometimes for a day on end, and they slowly worked. I think that's where the baseball glove and the baseball came.
And obviously the motorcycle.
Yeah, and the other thing I remember about the motorcycle was, of course, the wire that Bud Eakins drove the motorcycle in the jump. We made that, and we got long bales of that rubber wire, and we took pieces of stiff rubber and just wove it, twisted it into a twist, and every 6 inches you'd put one on. So the actual wire over which he jumped was completely made of rubber, and made by the cast, including me, I might say.
And I assume you were there watching when they made the jump. So what was that like watching the jump?
I've seen the movie so many times. I don't know whether I saw it when they did it, or I was down eating cul-de-sacs on my leg.
Ah, okay, that's fair. What was it like working under John Sturgis as a director? Was he helpful? Was he, was he stern with all of the actors? Because because it's an ensemble film, so therefore, you have a lot of strong personalities that are moving around there. But Sturgis is the one who needed to make sure to get everything done. What was it like working under him?
John Sturgis was tall and very avuncular and a warm personality who made you very welcome right from that letter when you first arrived. But he was a consummate director. He was a wonderful director. Bad Day at Black Rock, which I believe he directed, is another of those movies. I think he liked directing men more than women, but that was something I heard. And if you check his films, you could figure it out. But, they just don't come classier than the hero. It's such a terrible word. But he was. He had tremendous charisma.
Okay.
And he knew what he wanted. I mean, the film is take a look at the film. That is John Sturgis. That's the work he put into it, and it's immaculate.
Yeah, there's no question about that. I mean, it's a great movie. That's why we were doing the podcast on it. And I've seen the movie more than 20 times. It's definitely a film that's easy to get into, and you can feel how much fun, it seems as if all the actors had when they were making it. And based on what you said, it sounds that way.
I arrived on the camp for the first time, and we sort of walked through the gate and into the barbed wire enclosure. And I ambled up to a guy wearing a baseball cap. Probably said Brooklyn or Dodgers, or I don't know. I don't even know at this point. But he was, in his 50s, bordering on 60. Interesting looking man. And we started chatting about the whole thing. And I told him, I had worked with American companies and I was a British actor and all that. We chatted away. And, I thought he must be a grip or, an electrician. One of the working crew. And it was fascinating. And then we started to work, and the first thing that happened was a shot of the trucks coming in through the gate. So the camera was on a crane, which was going high up in the sky. And I looked up, and sitting on the crane was this guy next to the camera, the operator. Well, actually, he was operating. And I said to Strachan, "Who is that?" He said, "That's the great Danny Pham. That's the director of photography or whatever." But he was so unassuming and nice and welcoming. And that was my welcoming to American Pictures, Danny Pham, having a quiet chat, not knowing who he was. And then, of course, we had a prop man, Beady Eyes. And Beady Eyes, I don't know what his name is to this day, but he was from Brooklyn. And whenever John needed anything, he'd say, "Beady Eyes." And no matter where Beady Eyes were, you would hear this voice in the distance say, "I'm waking up." So, it's the first time you do a major American picture like that. It was fascinating to work and see how they function and how different it was. I can tell you one thing: there was no tea break.
Okay, well, because in British films they do have the tea break when they're making them.
The union has a tea break. I think they still do.
Uh-huh. Well, maybe it was because everyone wanted to get back to America after 12 weeks.
Well, it's different. The efficiency and the work ethic is completely different. It was then. I mean, I don't know what it is now. I always thought when Brexit happened, although it's sort of happening all the time, I thought, well, here is an opportunity for the British spirit and the British ideal of working hard and being better than anybody and producing goods that people say it's wonderful to be British. It never happened. It hasn't happened that I've noticed. And I went to buy a car once in a showroom, and it was, I think, in London. And one of the things it said, guaranteed not to be made in the United Kingdom, which I thought was a terrible indictment of work ethic in that country.
Okay, I can understand that. So what was it?
American crew, film crew back then, like a Swiss watch.
Well, do you think that had to do with the fact that it was John Sturges who was directing it, or all films at the time were run that way?
I think it's a consciousness of money. That, you know, there's the below the line and above the line.
Okay.
And if you waste time in any way at all, you're wasting money.
Right. Time is money.
I don't think, time is money. And I think they're very aware of that.
Oh, wow. Okay. So what was it like working as being part of an ensemble cast where, you know, a lot of the personalities, they might have caused some was there tension between the different actors?
No, it was one big happy family. And as I say, they meet up in groups and go off to, you know, check out Europe. You know, there's a wonderful thing that sometimes Americans do that makes me laugh. You know, what are you doing this weekend? Oh, we're going to do Berlin and Rome. I say, wait a minute, you're doing Berlin and Rome? I mean, yeah, we've only got one weekend and we really want to see both of those cities. I said, you know, you can spend a month in both cities individually. You know, a morning in one, which one's going to be the morning and which one's going to be the afternoon? I would suggest the evening in Rome, if I may, you know, because Trastevere and the antipasto on the sidewalk, you'll have a nice time in the evening. But it all amuses me. And so the cast had a tendency to, you know, there they were in, you know, the cradle of civilization, and they wanted to make sure that they saw it all.
Wow, that's really amazing. What did everyone think at the time that the movie was being made? Did everyone think that it would be a hit, that it would be something that the audiences would go for? I mean, it was one of the highest grossing films of the year, but what was the feeling when it was being made?
When you do anything, it doesn't matter what it is, you have no idea what it's going to be when it's finished. There's too many people involved, too many, you know, things, sound, camera, editing. I mean, there's so much. So there's no real way of knowing. When it was all over, I heard that it had turned out well. And so I went to the premiere in London at the Odeon Leicester Square. And the front three rows of the Odeon upstairs were all cordoned off to the cast. And I sat there, probably in around the third row. I think I was with Donald. He and I were sat together. And the lights dimmed at the appropriate time, and the curtains began to part. And as they parted, that music, that march started. And that atmosphere and that music and those curtains parting was a magic time that I can remember to this moment.
Wow. Wow, that's really amazing.
It was a spine tingle.
Yeah. Is there a particular scene in the movie, whether it was with your character or with another character, that you've always enjoyed, that you think is one of the best scenes in the movie?
Not really. My daughter has never seen the scene on the railway station. She said, I just don't want to see my father shot in the back.
Yes, but he did something heroic.
Yeah, but he didn't survive it.
Unfortunately, too many of the characters didn't make it.
Yeah, the fact that Hitler gave the order to kill them all was just dreadful.
Yes.
But it's, you know, there are a lot of dreadful things happened in that war.
Yes.
Also very interesting, a statistic came out here yesterday morning, that the COVID deaths in the United States, there are more people died of COVID-19 than everybody who died in World War I and World War II combined.
Wow.
Which is sort of a mind blower, you know.
In the U.S. or in the world? Maybe it was more Americans.
Yeah, I think it's the U.S.
Right.
It's half a million in the U.S.
Right.
Yeah. Wow.
Did after you made the movie, did you ever come in contact with any of the relatives of the real 50 or people who were familiar with the real story that spoke with you?
I yes, because there is a pub in London near King's Cross. When you go to King's Cross, you go to King's Cross to go to the pub. And there is the... No, wait a minute. I've got to be very careful here. So I did three things. I did The Great Escape. I did the Colditz series. And I did Freud, you know, which has nothing to do with escaping or anything. I get them a little mixed up sometimes. But the Escapee Society used to meet in that pub every year. And I think they were people from the Colditz series, The Escape from the Colditz Castle. But also, I think there was people from The Great Escape were there too. But I can't remember.
Mm-hmm. And do you recall having conversations? It doesn't matter if it was from Colditz or if it was from The Great Escape. And did you have conversations with them about the differences between, you know, fact and fiction of what happened?
Well, I've no idea.
Okay.
I mean, I can make up a lot of good stories for you, but I ain't going.
No, I want to hear the truth. We just want to hear the truth. That's it.
No.
Okay. Is there anything else that you feel is important that our listeners should hear about your experiences making the movie?
Well, there's a little joke in my family, in that I was married to Jill during The Great Escape, and Charlie Bronson came along, and we were confined in a prisoner of war camp. And after the prisoner of war camp was released from camp, shall we say? Yeah, we were released from the camp. Charles Bronson took my first wife, Jill, and married her subsequently. And I met Catherine, my wife now, which is K-A-T-H-E-R-I-N-E. But we're not doing print, so why am I saying that?
Okay.
But Catherine and I met, and we've been married for 53 years.
Wow.
We met 53 years ago and married for most of them. And that was my great escape. So there is that, a significant change in my life happened during the Great Escape. And now, of course, we have six Toherd grandchildren. And then all of a sudden, the 14-year-old is 6'2". Grandchildren suddenly are no longer grandchildren; they're young men. The way things change and move on, it's very significant. And the whole of World War II, we've moved on.
Correct.
But I think that's a very interesting record of what happened.
Yes. I definitely agree. We know that it's been fictionalized, but it still has the essence of the hope that all of those prisoners had, and they found a way to make their escape.
Right. Something I want to do, and I have to do it. The Rangers who went up the cliffs at Pas de Hoc, who actually opened up Europe to the rest of the armies. Spiked the guns on the cliffs at Pas de Hoc. And I know a number of them were captured. I just wondered if any of them had anything to do with the Great Escape.
Interesting. Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, the most from the research that I've done, almost all of the prisoners were Air Force officers. So my assumption is they were probably in a different camp, but it is possible.
Yes, that's right. Interesting. Well, I thank you. You prompted my memory. I'll think of all sorts of things I should have told you. But I hope you had enough.
Yes, we definitely did. This is I once again want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for agreeing to talk about your experiences during the making of The Great Escape. You've definitely enlightened me, and I'm sure you've enlightened all of our listeners to many little facts that we never would have known if we didn't have a chance to speak with you. So I thank you for that. I thank you for your time.
And any one of them who had been there when I was there would have realized what a wonderful experience it was. Not just Germany, but the movie and John Sturges and that whole company. And Maverick, as I used to call him. Just an extraordinary and wonderful time in my life.
Well, I appreciate and thank you for sharing those memories and experiences with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time and wish you the best of health.
Thank you.
And I wish you luck with all your endeavors, and you should have much time. You should have a lot of time to spend with your family.
Thank you. Much appreciated.
Yeah. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
I'm sorry, we weren't a little closer.
Yeah,
but it's a long time ago.
Yeah, but that's fine. It's still important that we can get these memories, recorded now.
Yeah,
that's the important thing.
I tell you a story about Donald Pleasance. It's quite amusing.
Sure.
Dealt with the fact that Donald had a house in France. And he was in the house in France. And towards the end, he drank rather a lot of champagne. And eventually it killed him. And I heard that he died. So I called his wife, who I knew well. And I said, "Darling, I'm really sorry I heard about Donald. It's just awful what happened." And she said, "Oh, David, it's so terrible. It's just awful. He just died. I mean, it didn't have to die. I mean, yeah, hold on a minute," she said. "He's here. I'll call you back." She hung up. Now, that's how it happened. A very short call. So I thought, she's lost it. And then the phone rang about an hour later. And she said, "I'm sorry I had to go, darling, but Donald's here." I said, "He's there?" He said, "Yeah. His body, it just flew in from Gatwick, and I put him in the back room." "We're going to bury him with his family or whatever." Da, 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 da. But that's what it was. But when she said, "He's here," I didn't realize it was the body that was there, not him.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, Donald.
And the way that we sign off on this podcast is we say tally-ho. which, you know, your character in the movie said it a number of times. So if you'd like, you can give a little tally-ho shout-out.
Oh, tally-ho.
Yeah, there you go. Perfect. Tally-ho.